Welcome back to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. Joining me is my guest co-host, D.R. Tucker. You are my doctor. You're my doctor when I feel sick to my stomach. You tell me that we got to hang in there, D.R., and you're bringing this information to mainstream America. And the person who's really done that in a very impactful way is our next guest. Very pleased to have Dr. Michael Mann with us. He's written a new book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars. He's also a professor and director at the Earth System Science Center at Penn State University. He's been on a book tour, so you may have seen him or heard him recently, but we're going to have him for the full half hour, and I've got lots of questions to ask that you may not have heard him answer yet, because some of us cover this stuff pretty closely. So we do want to do a little brief background and find out, as I called you, Dr. Mann, the accidental warrior, how you went from tracking climate oscillations to being the target of character assassinations. Oh, what a couple of years it's been.
Yeah, well, I started out as a theoretical physicist back in the 1990s. I ended up learning that there was fascinating science being done that made use of the physics and math background that I had to study Earth's climate. And so I switched into this field. I was interested in climate modeling the Earth's climate system. And as we tried to study the natural variability of the climate, and we realized that we needed longer-term records than what the instrumental record provides. We only have about 100 years of thermometer measurements, so we have to use other lines of evidence like tree rings and corals and ice cores to extend the record back in time if we really want to understand the long-term natural variability of the climate. And so it was our interest in these natural variations and oscillations in the climate that led us to study these sorts of data. And what they told us was, in fact, that the changes that we've seen over the past century really were unprecedented in a very long term. And it led to the publication of a graph referred to now as the hockey stick graph. The term was actually given by a colleague of mine from a modeling group, a climate modeling group in Princeton. He applied that term to this graph that we produced that showed relatively warm conditions about 1,000 years ago, and then the decline of temperatures into the so-called Little Ice Age of the 17th through 19th centuries, followed by the abrupt warming of the past century. That sort of evolution looking somewhat like a hockey stick, with the blade of the hockey stick being the modern warming that we found to be without precedent in a long-term context, at least as far back as we could go, 1,000 years. And so that graphic actually became an icon in the climate change debate. And as you alluded to earlier, my co-authors and I found ourselves in the center of this larger debate over human-caused climate change. And we found ourselves subject to attacks against our work and attacks against our scientific integrity by those who thought that if they could discredit our work, that they would be able to sort of discredit climate research in general.
Now, it's been a while since I've seen An Inconvenient Truth, since I was fortunate enough to see it when it came out with Vice President Al Gore in attendance. But is the hockey stick, is that the graph where you see Mr. Gore go up in the forklift?
No, it isn't. There's actually a wide misconception about that. That particular graphic is depicting how carbon dioxide concentrations have changed over many hundreds of thousands of years. And what it demonstrates is that the changes in our atmospheric composition, in the concentrations of CO2, this potent greenhouse gas in the atmosphere, that the increase over the past two centuries is without precedent for hundreds of thousands of years. And so we know that we have increased the levels of these greenhouse gases, CO2 and other greenhouse gases, to levels not seen, in fact, probably in millions of years. And based on the basic physics and chemistry of the greenhouse effect, which has been known for nearly two centuries, it would be very surprising if that hadn't led to a prominent warming of our climate. And guess what? The observations tell us that it has. And if we continue on this course that we're on, we will see much larger changes in the future.
And for those who say, how can man, little man, even many little men and women and children across the planet have an impact on, you know, the atmosphere? Well, the thin layer of atmosphere, you know, as we saw in An Inconvenient Truth, is very vulnerable and really is keeping our ecosystem in balance. And that's a gross generalization, of course, because there's so much interconnectedness and so much life that is, you know, threatened in terms of, you know, someone said it's like pulling on, you know, a spider's web, you know, a cobweb, and you pull on one end and it impacts all the way through. When you understand that, it's really, like you said, not surprising that we are, you know, really seeing some impact of spewing CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere for, you know, more than, well, 100 years now.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, the real issue, some people will sometimes say, well, look, you know, millions of years ago, 100 million years ago, when dinosaurs were roaming the polar regions of the planet, and these greenhouse gas concentrations were much higher than modern levels, you know, life seemed to flourish then. Why can't it? You know, why are these changes necessarily bad for us? And there's a fallacy implicit in that reasoning that it's the state of the climate itself which represents the problem. The real problem is that we are adapted. You know, we have a population much larger than any the Earth has ever had to support before, a population of human beings, and we are highly dependent on the stability of the environment that we adapted to. And what we're doing is changing the atmosphere composition and changing our climate dramatically and in ways that are going to set in motion changes in our environment that are simply too rapid for us to adapt to. That's really the problem.
Okay, and let's clarify something else. Were you the target of smears and, you know, intimidation before the whole ClimateGate controversy? And what role, if any, did you play in that? And what has been determined ultimately about that hacking of emails and the distortion of the context of those emails being taken out of context?
Right. Well, this is I sort of tell the whole story in my book, the Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, where I essentially use my story, my personal experiences for more than a decade, in fact, in the center of the attacks against climate science to talk about many of these larger issues. And so, indeed, I have been an object of attack by climate change deniers, those who seek to deny the basic science, often working essentially as advocates for vested interests who don't want to see us shift away from our reliance on fossil fuels for energy. There is an entire apparatus, much like, you know, the tobacco industry hired scientists and created lavishly funded front groups to try to discredit the science linking the use of their product and adverse health effects like lung cancer. The fossil fuel industry has essentially gone back to that same playbook and tried to do everything they can to discredit the science and of climate change. And when our work came to prominence back more than a decade ago, when it was featured prominently in the summary for policymakers of the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that really helped propel the hockey stick graph into sort of iconic status. And once it achieved that status, it was something that as climate change deniers felt they needed to go after it, they needed to take it down because it was perceived as being such a compelling piece of evidence for the reality of climate change. Now, in reality, it's not. There are many independent lines of evidence, some of them just basic physics and chemistry, as I alluded to earlier, that tells us that, of course, the planet has to warm as we increase the concentrations of these gases in the atmosphere. We don't need a hockey stick or any other lines of paleoclimate evidence to conclude that. But it was this iconic graph, and climate change deniers felt that they needed to bring down this icon, and so we have been subject to smear campaign. I, in particular, have been subject to these sorts of smear campaigns for more than a decade, and as I describe in the book, from, you know, efforts by prominent politicians like James Inhofe, Republican senator from Oklahoma, largest recipient of fossil fuel money in the U.S. Senate. He went after us. He attacked our work in a series of Senate hearings he held back in 2003, 2004. And then Joe Barton, another prominent Republican politician, chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee back in 2005, wanted to launch an investigation into me and my co-authors because of a criticism of our work that he read on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal. And so this has become par for the course, not just for me, but for many climate scientists. And indeed, we've been subject to not just smear campaigns, but threats against our life, efforts to get us fired from our institutions, efforts to discredit us, to ridicule us. And it sort of reached a crescendo, if you will, with the so-called ClimateGate episode back in November 2009, just weeks away from this very important summit in Copenhagen, the December 2009 Copenhagen summit, which was the first opportunity in years for meaningful progress in terms of how the world deals with the problem of climate change. In the weeks leading up to that, those looking to basically to scuttle any meaningful discussion in Copenhagen created, they manufactured this fake scandal known as ClimateGate, where they stole thousands of emails between many different climate scientists, including me, and they took words and phrases out of context to try to make it sound like scientists were fudging the data. And there was this campaign mostly originating in sort of right-leaning media venues, which was then propelled onto TV screens and newspapers, and you know, many of your listeners will have heard about this fake scandal called ClimateGate. Well, it turns out since then there have been, I think, 9 different investigations in the U.S. and the U.K., including one by the National Science Foundation's Inspector General most recently, and they have all found that there was no wrongdoing at all on the part of the scientists, and the real wrongdoing was the fact that those looking to scuttle any meaningful effort to deal with the problem basically set back efforts several years by creating this fake scandal and leading the public to believe that the science is not certain enough to act upon, when in fact we know enough to conclude that if we don't act, the costs will be far greater than any costs of acting.
And Pierre Tucker is going to jump in now, and I know you've probably been communicating with him, but he actually read the IPCC report, you know, a few years ago, and that made all the difference. If only everybody would, and then see what they have to say.
Sure.
Dr. Mann, it's an honor to speak with you. I should note, you mentioned Joe Barton, that in the April 9th edition of The New Yorker, Steve Call notes, quote, "In the past decade, the leading recipient of ExxonMobil PAC contributions has been Representative Joe Barton," unquote, and I'm sure that's just a coincidence. But in any event, do you have any theories as to who did the original ClimateGate email hack?
Well, you know, the authorities are still looking into this, and we still don't know the precise group of criminals who actually performed the theft of emails. What we do know, however, is that the various groups and organizations and individuals that immediately launched this campaign of vilification, this smear campaign against climate science and climate scientists, interestingly enough, they were all associated with fossil fuel special interests, whether it is, you know, the various front groups or pseudo news outlets that propelled this story out into the public sphere that are funded by fossil fuel special interests, or private fossil fuel interests like the Koch brothers, KOCH, Koch Industries, or in the SCAFE foundations, another conservative foundation that engages in sort of efforts to discredit science that's inconvenient to the fossil fuel industry.
The Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Competitive Enterprise Institute, essentially another front group of these various groups, Koch Industries and the SCAFE foundations. And so in the book, I describe how when I followed back, you know, the threads, the various attacks against me, they always led to the same place. They always led to groups that were being funded by some combination of fossil fuel industry money or these two conservative foundations, the Koch Industries and the SCAFE foundations. All of these attacks against me, whether within Pennsylvania, whether it was the effort to get local politicians to try to pressure Penn State University to fire me, or the attack ads that were run against me in my own student newspaper, in the Penn State college newspaper, I actually had to put up with attacks against me being run in our university newspaper by a group that calls itself the Commonwealth Foundation, which you might not be surprised to learn is a front for these fossil fuel special interests, the SCAFE foundations in particular. So, yes, we know that the campaign to discredit climate science, the smear campaign, was run by fossil fuel special interests and advocacy organizations that that support their agenda. So we don't, you know, even though we don't know who actually stole the emails, we know who was behind the larger campaign to discredit the science and to try to basically set us back years in terms of actually dealing with the problem by
settling
progress.
Setting back years, and these are very critical years, as you know, to are wasting precious time.
Well, that's right. I mean, in order to, you know, many of the scientists who study the impacts of climate change will tell you that if we raise CO2 concentrations much above around 450 parts per million, so every million parts in the atmosphere, if 450 of them or more are on average CO2 molecules, then we will set in motion changes in the climate system that will almost certainly have grave consequences for us, for our environment. And in order to avoid breaching that level of 450 ppm, well, right now we're at about 390 to 392. With each passing year, we are increasing concentrations by 2 to 3 ppm. So it won't take us very long to get to that 450 ppm level. At the current trajectory, if we follow the current trajectory, we'll be there in a matter of decades. In order to avoid doing that, we need to bring emissions to a peak now and to ramp them down dramatically over the next few decades. And so, as you can imagine, with each year where we don't do that, the challenge becomes even harder and harder to avoid passing that level of dangerous interference with our climate system.
Dr. Mann, you've also noted that when Congressman Barton started harassing you, you were actually defended by a moderate Republican, Congressman Sherwood Bollert, who left Congress in 2006. Are you disappointed by the fact that there are virtually no Republicans running, not only for president, but for any federal office today, who share Representative Bollert's views on climate change?
Well, you know, it is disappointing, although I did see just the other day I read that the Republican governor of Ohio, Kasich, mm-hmm. has actually recently expressed the view that climate change is a concern and it's something that we need to deal with. And other Republicans like Lindsey Graham have expressed, you know, concern about the problem of climate change. So I think that there are a number of politicians in both parties, you know, including the Republican Party, that are concerned about this issue but are afraid to speak up, because they're afraid that if they express concern about climate change, then some of the special interests that appear to have hijacked our elections in recent years will run them out of office, will, you know, primary them. And this is what happened to a number of Republicans a few years ago.
Bob Inglis and Mike Castle.
Oh, absolutely. And the list goes on. And so there's been this effort, unfortunately, by some of these same vested interests. For example, the Koch brothers, who have funded the essentially most of the campaign to deny climate change, they are also trying to essentially purify the Republican Party by purging it of any individuals who have a moderate view on this subject. And so it is a very disturbing development, because as I, you know, describe in my book, you know, I think as one would deduce from reading the book, that the single greatest hero in our story was a Republican politician who you mentioned, Sherwood Bollert. He was the former chair of the House Science Committee, and as the chair of the Science Committee, he came out and in the strongest terms condemned the attacks by his fellow Republican Joe Barton. And at the time, the Republicans had complete control of our government, both houses of Congress and the presidency, and there was almost nothing to stop Barton from proceeding with his witch hunt against me and other scientists had another member of his own party not come up to and come out and stand up for science and for decency, frankly. And so I do find it disturbing that that voices like Sherwood Bollert now are not nearly as strong as they need to be within that party, because, you know, climate change should not be a political partisan issue. And I can tell you, I have friends who are both Republicans and Democrats, and I am absolutely convinced that my Republican friends care every bit as much about their children and grandchildren and the world they inherit as my Democratic friends. And that's what this is really about, preserving the earth for future generations, not making decisions today that will condemn future generations to a fundamentally degraded planet, or a planet, as my colleague James Hansen has said, would no longer be Earth. It wouldn't be the planet that we grew up on.
Indeed. And yet, we do see more Republican legislators who are, deep in the pockets of deep-pocketed, fossil fuel interests. And why has it become so politicized, in your view? And it must end. You're right. And I started the America's Green Tea Party, for those of us who are esteemed that they are playing politics with our planet, whoever they happen to be, of any party. We need a Green Tea Party, because the Green Party, up until Dr. Jill Stein, who was on the show a few weeks ago, she's very impressive, they don't get enough of a, hearing. And given the enormity of the, green challenges we face and how everything else is dependent upon a sustainable environment, how can we turn up the volume so that this can, quickly be taken out of the political arena and made much more, practical, with a sense of urgency that can really penetrate and not just sort of prick the consciousness of mainstream Americans?
Well, I wish I had the answer to that question. I guess, like any of us, I have some thoughts about things that we can do to try to restore some sanity to the public discourse on issues like climate change. Fundamentally, we need to make sure that our policymakers are held accountable to their views and actions on issues of critical importance, like the world that, what world we're going to leave our children. And so, the most important thing that your viewers can do, in my view, is to vote in this next election and to try to ensure that that the politicians that they put in office represent their views, represent their concerns on this issue. And of course, there are things that one can do beyond voting, writing to your local congresspeople, being vocal about this issue locally, organizing your community, your neighbors in your community, to present a united voice of concern about issues like climate change. And so there are things that we can do voluntarily to try to, for example, decrease our carbon footprint. But ultimately, we're not going to solve the problem by voluntary measures alone, by, good people doing the right thing because they know it's right. We have to incentivize responsible behavior. We have to disincentivize irresponsible behavior when it comes to our environment. And right now, we have the entire incentive structure inverted, where we're actually providing subsidies to the fossil fuel industry, who are polluting our atmosphere for free, and we're not providing enough incentives to alternative technologies. I think one thing that's very important, because this has become so politicized, is to recognize why this isn't a political issue. It's an issue of competitiveness internationally. Right now, the rest of the world, China, recognizes that the future of the global economy is in developing renewable, new energy technologies, and they're moving ahead. And meanwhile, we are falling behind in the global marketplace, because we've been hijacked by those who want to continue to litigate whether or not there's even a problem, that we haven't been allowed to have that good faith debate about what to do about the problem, and in particular how to move ahead with the incentive structure in our energy economy that will allow us to grow the economy and develop these new energy technologies and not continue to degrade the planet. So there's a lot of work to be done, and every one of your listeners can play a role by becoming active in whatever way makes the most sense for them.
Speaking of moving forward, are you hopeful that there will be climate legislation that will be passed in the next few years, or do you think that Exxon and their allies will continue to sort of pressure the Senate not to take action? And also, what policy should be implemented to reduce emissions if one does get passed through Congress? Do you support a second effort at cap and trade, or do you prefer, say, a fee and dividend approach?
Yeah, so that's great questions. Let me tackle the second one first. I, as a scientist, I like to reserve judgment on with regard to what particular policy prescription will work best. I leave that to, you know, policymakers and economists to make the right decision, as long as it's premised on an accurate understanding of the nature of the problem. And so my view is that my role as a scientist is to make sure that those discussions are informed by an accurate and honest assessment of the costs of inaction. How we, you know, actually implement a policy that will balance the costs and the benefits of different energy strategies. You know, we can have that good faith discussion. I wish that that is the discussion we were having in Congress today, rather than this bad faith debate about whether the problem even exists. And so ultimately, you know, whether we go with a cap and trade or a carbon tax and how much the carbon tax should be, or a cap and dividend, I wish we were having that honest discussion of what's the best policy prescription for moving forward. Ultimately, I think we can agree that we have to internalize the cost of emitting carbon into the atmosphere into the economic decision-making process. My friend Bill McKibben, I think, has put it very well when he says the fossil fuel industry has been given the greatest subsidy imaginable. They are allowed to dump their waste directly into our atmosphere at no cost. And that has to stop. We have to internalize that cost to the environment. And how precisely we do that, we can have a good faith debate about that. I forgot the first part of your question, actually.
I was saying, do you have hope that some sort of climate legislation will be passed in the next few years in Congress, or do you think that the tyranny of the fossil fuel companies
right.
will continue to exert itself over the House and Senate?
Well, you know, that it's a great question. I hold out hope that we'll move ahead, and I think ultimately it's a matter of the public mindset, the public perception. As the public increasingly demands that we take action, as they increasingly see the impacts of climate change, and you know, the fact that we just had, for the first time in history, in 2011, had 13 different weather and climate related disasters that cost more than $1 billion. So we are seeing huge costs of inaction right now, and ultimately, I think as people continue to feel those impacts, they're going to demand that their policymakers represent their views. And this is, there was actually a memo that was leaked back in 2002. I talk about this in the book, the infamous Luntz memo, Republican pollster Frank Luntz, who basically what he outlined here, it was a strategy for inaction. He was advising opponents of carbon regulation on how they could frame the public debate to ensure that there would be no pressure to take action. And what Luntz basically said was that there was this closing window. The public was becoming convinced that the science was in and that there really was a problem. And should they become convinced, they would demand action by their policymakers. But there was still a narrow window of opportunity to manufacture doubt and confusion. And controversy, just like what the tobacco industry did decades ago, and that's the path that those he was advising, the fossil fuel industry and the politicians who are implementing their agenda, that's the path they chose. But I believe that the public is increasingly recognizing that the problem is real, and the recent Gallup poll actually seems to validate that. And as they do, they will increasingly require that their policymakers represent their concerns. Now, at the same time, because there's so much of a focus of, you know, the special interests are dumping millions of dollars into the national political campaigns to try to make sure that our elected representatives don't act on this problem, that there are other avenues that, you know, those who are concerned about this problem are pursuing now, more sort of bottom-up rather than top-down. Municipalities and states organizing together to pass their own legislation to basically try to confront the climate change challenge. And as municipalities and states band together, perhaps the solution will ultimately come from literally from the grassroots up, rather than from sort of top-down national-level legislation. We'll have to see, but I think it makes sense to be pursuing both strategies.
Absolutely. We just have a couple minutes left. I really would love to get your opinion on nuclear power. Is that part of the solution given the climate crisis, or is that not the way to go? How's that for a last-minute good question?
I thought I was going to escape without having to tackle that one. You know, and I get that question just about every public lecture that I give about climate change, and it's a fair question. It's a good question, and it's hard to give a good answer in the sense that, you know, if we look at the challenge that we're up against, as you know, other, you know, as the in, the you know, developing world comes online with their own energy economies, as China and India and South American countries are now increasing their demand for energy, global energy demand is only going to go up for the foreseeable future, and if we're going to meet that growing demand in a way that doesn't continue to contribute to the climate change problem, we are going to have to, you know, have a difficult discussion about how we can do that. What energy technologies can allow us to meet growing energy demands while not continuing to contribute to our global carbon emissions and climate change.
Well, maybe.
And just about everything, you know, needs to be on the table. And it may be that some, you know, options that aren't ideal, like nuclear, we might have to keep them on the table just as part of that bridge, you know, of a decade or two decades to where we can meet our energy demands with renewable energy technology. We will
thank
be
you,
there
Dr.
in a
Michael Mann. We're out of time. I'm so sorry to cut you off, but really thank you for your shedding more light than heat. Too much out there is doing just the heat part, and that's why we need to get a show on that talks about not only the challenges but the solutions. We'd love to have you on as our first guest when we get that show on for network television, hopefully. Thanks for your wonderful contribution to the conversation, your book, The Hockey Stick and the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Hopefully we're not pucked. See you next time.